morning. This is AM. I'm Tony Eastley. The regulation of the national carrier is back on the agenda after the Federal Treasurer canvassed the idea of ditching ownership restrictions and even providing Qantas with government aid. At a business function yesterday, Joe Hockey opened discussion about the Qantas Sale Act, which dictates the airline must be at least 51% Australian-owned. Mr. Hockey said the rules were inflexible and he raised the possibility that Qantas might need public funds. Qantas has been lobbying furiously for government help in the face of increasing foreign support for its rival Virgin Australia. Lexi Metherill reports.
Chatham House rules were in place at the business function where the Treasurer spoke, so neither he nor the meeting should have been identified, but someone wanted his views known, and soon the Australian Financial Review had obtained a transcript of his comments, and the Australian newspaper was raising them with Qantas's chief executive, Alan Joyce, at a separate event.
I mean, what do you say to Joe Hockey's comments today?
What we've seen in Canberra is the politicians listening to our arguments, the politicians saying there is an unlevel playing field here.
It's understood Joe Hockey's called for a debate on whether Australia still wants a national carrier. A long-standing opponent of easing restrictions on Qantas's ownership is happy to weigh in.
My fear is that Qantas will either be vulnerable to a private equity takeover or foreign takeover.
The independent Senator Nick Xenophon.
Both scenarios are bad for Australian jobs, for Qantas's international and national reputation, and my fear is that the Qantas we know today will just become a shadow of itself.
Qantas is furious Virgin Australia is receiving a $350 million injection from its foreign owners, Etihad, Air New Zealand and Singapore Airlines, and it wants the government to review whether its majority foreign-owned rival should be able to access traffic rights reserved for Australian airlines. CEO Alan Joyce doesn't just want the focus on the Qantas Sale Act.
The issues about the Qantas Sale Act is it's going to need an Act of Parliament to repeal it. And I think in the current Parliament, getting it through the lower house and the upper house is an issue for us. We need urgent, immediate action on this.
The Australian and International Pilots Association supports easing restrictions on Qantas's ownership. The association's president, Nathan Safe, is expecting the government to review the airline's situation.
Whether it's done by someone like the Productivity Commission or by the Senate or by the Department of Transport, that remains to be seen. But when this review does take place, we think it's vital that everyone has their chance to have their say.
Alan Joyce has pointed out that it would take quite a long time for the legislative process to roll out for the Qantas Sale Act to be scrapped or significantly amended. And he wants more immediate action, like restrictions on Virgin. Do you support that?
Look, I think the horse has probably bolted on imposing regulatory restrictions on Virgin. It's a bit of a grey area as to whether they're really going along with the intent of the Air Navigation Act. They are now, once this capital raising is complete, almost an 80% foreign-owned entity. Whether or not that's in the spirit of the Air Navigation Act is a question for someone else. But what we want to see is Qantas able to compete, able to access capital on the same terms as Virgin, so that it has a long-term chance of being viable as a business and as an employer.
The Australian and International Pilots Association's President Nathan Safe, ending Lexi Metherill's report. From the air or the sea, the small group of uninhabited islands in the East China Sea don't look all that remarkable, but they are at the centre of a dispute that has the potential to pit world powers against each other, and already Australia finds itself caught up in the row. The string of islands are known as Diaoyu in China and Senkaku in Japan. Tensions over them have resurfaced after China's announcement of an expanded air defence zone. China is insisting all aircraft must notify its authorities before entering the airspace, which includes islands controlled by Japan but claimed by Beijing. As North America correspondent Jane Cowan reports, the dispute has drawn in Australia as well as Japan and the United States.
The airspace dispute has unquestionably raised tensions in the region. The US has ignored Chinese claims to the zone, flying two B-52s through it while pointedly not notifying Chinese authorities. The Foreign Minister spokesman, Xing Gong, didn't criticise the American mission, but suggested China had the situation under control. The Chinese government has ample resolve and capability to defend the country's sovereignty and security, he said. The B-52s were a clear warning. The US plans to push back on what it sees as an aggressive Chinese posture. The incoming US ambassador to China, Caroline Kennedy, is calling for level heads.
In dangerous times, the United States has always stood for the principle that disputes should be resolved through diplomacy.
Major airlines, including Qantas and Singapore Airlines, have said they'll comply and inform China of their flight plans. But the Japanese government has now instructed its two largest airlines to ignore Beijing's demands. Kunihiko Miyake is research director at the Kennan Institute of Global Studies in Tokyo.
It is a provocative act which not only Japan but all the international community cannot tolerate.
The move by China is a backward step that runs counter to recent efforts to reassure neighbours of its good intentions and could add momentum to America's efforts to shift military assets to Asia.
They do not want a confrontation with the United States over this.
Ken Lieberthal is a former presidential advisor who now specialises in China at the Brookings Institution. He says it could be a tit-for-tat response to a recent Japanese announcement that they could shoot down Chinese drones intruding into contested airspace.
It also plays into a consistent, gradual effort by the Chinese to increasingly assert their rights to basically administer the territory around these contested islands.
The Chinese have sternly rebuked Australia's Foreign Minister Julie Bishop for protesting against the expanded airspace, saying Australia shouldn't take sides and her comments risk damaging the relationship between China and Australia. But Brookings' Ken Lieberthal is dismissive.
Well, first of all, I hope you don't listen to what the Chinese have said on that. I think that it's perfectly appropriate for Australia to do what the U.S. will do and many others, which is not to notify the Chinese when they go through this zone.
The dispute's bound to overshadow a long-planned trip that the US Vice President Joe Biden makes to the region next week. This is Jane Cowan in Washington for AM.
Secular protesters are returning to the streets of Egypt and many are speaking out against severe new laws aimed at limiting dissent. Egypt's military-backed government is attracting global condemnation for a new law cracking down on demonstrators. For the third day running, security forces dispersed protesters overnight using tear gas as well as water cannon. Human rights activists are now worried about promised elections next year. Here's Middle East correspondent Hayden Cooper.
The streets around Tahrir Square have seen their share of protests in the past 2 years. Now they're filling with dissent again. This week's demonstrators aren't made up of Islamist Muslim Brotherhood supporters. Instead, they are Egyptian liberals, secularists and pro-democracy activists, angry at the increasingly hard line taken by the military-backed government.
What we're doing here, we're standing against the real terrorists of the state, of the who have been ruled by the martial system, killing innocent people, arresting righteous political activists in such a way that has no relationship with human rights or has no relationship with the real January 25 revolution or even the 30 June revolution. That's what happened today.
Overnight, protesters gathered again in Alexandria and were met with tear gas. In Cairo, crowds demonstrated against a plan to force civilians to face military trials under the next constitution. They were there also to condemn new laws introduced this week, severely curtailing public protests. They require prior approval for gatherings of more than 10 people, allow police to respond with force, and include 5-year jail terms for protesters.
We're very concerned about this new protest and assembly law because it sets some vague ground that allows security officers to ban any protest, really.
Tamara Al-Rafai is the Cairo-based spokeswoman for Human Rights Watch. She says the laws are a worrying sign ahead of a crucial year for Egypt that's expected to include presidential and parliamentary elections.
This country has witnessed over the past now almost 3 years massive demonstrations and people finally being able to organize and to mobilize and to request things and to request to participate in politics. And by imposing such a law that restricts their ability to even engage in public space, I don't see how we will be able to witness free and fair elections or to invite the opposition to organize itself and organize its own campaign.
As security forces implement their latest crackdown, the drafting of Egypt's new constitution goes on ahead of a referendum in January. This is Hayden Cooper reporting for AM.
And you are listening to AM around Australia, where it's 20 and a half minutes past seven. Proponents of wind energy have had a victory with two bodies ruling wind farms don't cause health problems. Some opponents of wind farms claim low frequency sounds damage people's health. But the lack of evidence supporting that fact was noted by the Victorian Civil and Administrative Tribunal in its decision to give the go-ahead for a wind farm near Seymour, just north of Melbourne. With more, here's David Mark.
When it's built, the Cherry Tree Wind Farm will have 16 turbines. The proponents are Infigen Energy, whose manager of development is David Griffin.
The common frame is how many households that would generate electricity for. A wind farm of that size would be in the order of approximately 20,000 homes.
The proposal was initially knocked back by the local council, but now Infigen has had a win via the Victorian Civil and Administrative Tribunal. That's despite the fact the proposal was opposed by two anti-wind farm groups, the Warburg Foundation and the Landscape Guardians.
The tribunal also noted there was a huge weight of submissions given by those opposed to the project, but they couldn't see merit in those submissions.
The tribunal found the current state of scientific opinion was that there was no causal link of a physiological nature between adverse health effects and wind turbines. It was given no evidence at all that would justify the tribunal adopting a view that was opposed to the clearly stated opinions of the health authorities. In South Australia, the EPA has just finished a study looking at residents living near the Waterloo wind farm north of Adelaide. Again, it found there was no evidence linking noise from the turbines to adverse health impacts. Some local residents complained about a low rumbling noise, but at times that rumbling occurred when the wind farm was shut down. Russell Marsh is the Director of Policy at the Clean Energy Council, the industry's peak body.
That sends a great message to the industry. It also should send a good message to communities across Australia, because what it shows is that, you know, they have nothing to worry about in terms of some of the health claims that are made about wind farms.
Not so, says Sarah Laurie. She's the CEO of the Warburg Foundation.
There is certainly a recognition by the tribunal members that some people are reporting some fairly serious health problems, including sleep disturbance.
That may be so, but the tribunal found that there was no causal link between the noise from the wind turbines and adverse health impacts, and you didn't provide any evidence to suggest that there was any link.
That's not correct. We actually did provide evidence. However,
but they found that it wasn't credible.
Look, the tribunal members have made their decision. There certainly is a link.
But Russell Marsh from the Clean Energy Council says that if there is a link, it's not caused by noise from wind turbines, it's caused by groups like the Warburg Foundation.
And, you know, we think there is a case for saying that actually people are getting afraid of wind turbines in their area because they are told that there will be some problems by some of the anti-groups. And as we're seeing today, you know, a lot of those claims, particularly around health, are unfounded.
Russell Marsh, the Director of Policy at the Clean Energy Council, ending David Mark's report. Researchers say young children in regional Australia lag behind those in cities when it comes to key aspects of early learning. The Australian Institute of Family Studies also compared social and educational results for children in disadvantaged and advantaged homes. But it's the findings that children in regional areas trail urban children in the key areas of vocabulary development and abstract problem solving that will certainly generate the most attention. Social affairs correspondent Norman Hammond reports.
You're doing some great reading there.
Special.
In a classroom in western Queensland, there's a map of the solar system on the wall, but just one teacher wearing a headset. She speaks into a computer screen where she can see her students. Two young boys somewhere out in the more than 400,000 square kilometres in this school district. New research suggests this is the kind of technology needed to close a gap in early cognitive development between young children in regional Australia and those in cities. For 5 years, researchers collected data on children aged 4 to 9 on their learned vocabulary and nonverbal problem solving. Ben Edwards from the Australian Institute of Family Studies says in both crucial areas of early development, children in regional Australia lag behind their urban counterparts.
Having a good start is really critically important. What we find in this study is that kids tend to struggle more in terms of their learning outcomes early in primary school in those regional areas.
The differences in early learning are not large, but they are enough, say the study's authors, to mean on average, regional children can lag behind all through their later schooling. At regional universities, educators like Julie Rowlands of Deakin University's Warrnambool campus in Victoria have long recognized their new students often enter with lower levels of academic preparation.
If you grow up in a family where there are no members of the family who've been to university, then you don't have any idea about what university is like. And certainly the way parents speak to and interact with their children is going to be influenced by their own educational experiences and the educational experiences of those around them.
But there's a flip side to this study. Young children in regional areas may lag somewhat behind city kids in early childhood learning, but Ben Edwards of the Australian Institute of Family Studies says they're ahead when it comes to social and emotional well-being.
There's often a stereotype that family support, community support is stronger in a regional area than it might be in an urban area.
We find that, Norman.
So what we find is that there tends to be a greater sense of belonging. There tends to be more engagement in community activities in those regional areas compared to the major cities. So it's buffering or strengthening these families and these children's development in other ways apart from learning outcomes.
Ben Edwards from the Australian Institute of Family Studies. Ending that report from Norman Hammond. Links to the study can be found on our website. Just type ABC space AM into a search engine to find it. Nearly 60 years ago in Canberra, a very young Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip met one of Australia's up-and-coming artists who gave them one of his paintings. Albert Namatjira was fast making a reputation for his watercolour landscapes. 6 decades on, that meeting has come full circle, with his grandchildren visiting the Queen at Buckingham Palace. Correspondent Philip Williams has the story.
On a cold grey London day, Lenny and Kevin Namatjira had an appointment with a rather famous lady.
This is your painting?
Yeah, Alice Springs.
Back in the 1940s, their grandfather Albert had sent Queen Elizabeth one of his landscape paintings to celebrate her 21st birthday. Then in 1954, he met the Queen and Prince Philip in Canberra. The Duke was clearly impressed and privately purchased more of his paintings and several done by one of his sons. Now it was the turn of the grandchildren to present the Queen with their paintings, the third generation of Namatjiras in the Royal Collection. Outside the palace, I caught up with Lenny and Kevin Namatjira just after the audience.
What's it mean for your family, the whole family, to be here today?
Oh, they feel proud.
For Lenny Namatjira, the visit was also a proud family moment.
I was pleased to see her and give my painting to her.
But Lenny and Kevin Namatjira's visit to London had deeper purpose. They're both part of a sell-out play at London's South Bank about their grandfather Albert's life.
Our young queen awards Albert the Coronation Medal. How deeply he bows before this little girl from London.
In the background, during the performance, Lenny and Kevin Namatjira work on a huge landscape drawing. Scott Rankin is the author and director of the play called simply Namatjira.
It's 20 generations since Shakespeare, and we think of that as the heritage. But the Western Aranda people, Albert Namatjira's people, it's 2,000 generations of work, of culture, of drama, of art and of music. So, of course, if you're privileged to live in the old world of Australia, which we are, then it's a terrific thing to bring that to the new world of Europe and just reverse that preconceived paradigm.
Beyond the play and the art, a little politics, a nudge for the new federal government not to forget Indigenous arts funding.
The art of Central Australia and the Indigenous art of the whole continent is the face of Australia internationally. So if we're going to trade on it, we need to support it.
For all the attention in London, Lenny and Kevin Namatjira will return to uncertain futures in Alice Springs. From Buckingham Palace to no fixed abode, the accolades in the British capital will give way to a very different reality back home. This is Philip Williams in London, reporting for AEM.
To the financial markets, and the Dow Jones in late trade was up 32 points. The dollar is weaker. It's currently buying 91 US cents, 93 Japanese yen, and 67 euro cents. I'm Tony Eastley. Thanks for your company this morning, and that is AM for today.